I'm Dan Runcie, the host and founder of Trapital, and you're about to listen to another conversation from our Trapital Summit. This is a talk that kicked the whole day off. We knew we wanted to start off on the right note, so I'm grateful to have been joined by the co-founder and CEO of Venice Music, Troy Carter. Whenever Troy and I get to catch up and talk, we always go into these deep, high-level conversations on where we think things are going in the industry. And Troy's never afraid to call things like it is, so that's the exact tone that we wanted to keep and translate to the conference itself. And that's exactly what we talked about. The theme of this conversation was what's next. Streaming has been the dominant platform for well over a decade, and we've seen the positive impact that's had on the industry, but nothing lasts forever. And there's a lot of changes that we can see, especially as you look at the earnings and you hear some of the tea leaves of what's happening for some of the large companies in the space, but also some of the M&A activity with some of the smaller players too. So Troy and I talk about that and make some bold predictions for where we think the industry is going. Again, really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do too. Let's dive in.
Hello, podcast listeners. I have a question for you. What if you had a window into the digital startup world? What if you could ask the tech veterans what it feels like to create a world-class product? How to recover from critical mistakes? How to scale your solution to the masses? How do you get from an idea on the back of a napkin to a fully functioning product? What if you could hear the human stories about how they delivered technology? What if there was a show where you could hear those stories?
This is Code Story, a podcast bringing you interviews with tech visionaries.
Spent 6 months moonlighting.
There's nothing on the back end.
Who share what it takes to change an industry.
I don't exactly know what to do next.
Took many goes to get right.
Who built the teams that have their back.
A company is its people.
The teams help each other achieve
Most proud of our team.
Keeping scalability top of mind.
All that infrastructure was a
Yes, we've been fighting it as we grow.
Total waste of time.
The stories you don't read in the headlines.
It's not an easy thing to achieve, mind
you. Took it off the shelf and dusted it off and tried it again.
To ride the ups and downs of the startup life.
You need to really want it.
It's not just about technology.
All this and more on Code Story.
Make sure you subscribe to the Code Story podcast today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the podcasting app of your choice. And thanks again for listening.
Troy, great to see you.
Good to see you, man.
Before we queued things up, the producers had Dreams and Nightmare queued up, but they had that second part, hold up, wait a minute. Uh-huh. And I was like, no, it's 9:15. It's too early for all. But Troy, again, appreciate you doing this. And I thought it'd be good to kick the day off with you. Whenever you and I catch up, it's big picture conversations. And I feel like it's always a timely moment too. And we're in one of those right now. I think there's a lot of opportunity with where things are going in the industry, with how streaming has gone the past couple of years, but the contraction is starting to hit and people are wondering where we're going. So what's your take on where things are right now in music?
It feels like, you know, we're reaching a maturity level in certain areas. And, you know, we've seen this before in terms of shifts of power and shifts of consumption. You know, history repeats itself. So, you know, we got sort of hooked on video with MTV and sort of gave it away there. You know, we got sort of hooked on iTunes, gave it away there. Hooked on streaming, gave it away there. And, you know, and now we're looking at TikTok and other platforms or whatever. And I think, you know, we got to get to a place eventually where the industry determines its own future. And I think this is the opportunity for that shift to finally happen. And so who takes advantage of it will be the winners. And who sort of tries to allow history to repeat itself again will probably end up being the losers.
Are you optimistic of the music industry's ability to take advantage of that?
I'm optimistic about the entrepreneurs who are in the music industry right now, who are pushing towards that change and who have raised capital to support that change as well. So I don't think it's necessarily going to happen coming from major label systems. I definitely know it's not going to happen from there, But I do feel like there's going to be a lot of changes that'll be more entrepreneurial.
Because I think part of that tension is that for years, any of the innovation that has come outside of the major label or any of the incumbents, it often felt like there's a ceiling of what they could get to, whether they're either tried to be squashed down or they end up being acquired because there is just so much control. But you've also seen a lot of things shift where there isn't as much consolidated power. You're seeing more opportunity happening and growth happening outside of the major label system.
There were issues there before, you know, and mostly around cash flow issues. You know, so if you were an independent label, you know, years ago, like with any entrepreneurial business, you're hustling. And so when you get that opportunity to sell the company or find a partner to come in, there were only a handful of buyers that could do it, three or four that could do it. Now, when you look at the amount of capital that's flooded the business, you know, from private equity, from family offices, you look at the cash flow from streaming and things like that, where you get paid every month and, you know, and those receivables are real receivables, you don't necessarily have to sell to a label anymore like you used to, or have to do a joint venture like you used to. You can now be a lot more entrepreneurial and take advantage of those opportunities. Now the labels are looking at, how do I get into that business? You know, as we're hearing about, you know, these new sort of super premium tiers and other lines of businesses that the labels are looking at, those are businesses that I was in 20 years ago. It's called the management business. It's like, you know, you benefit from, you know, really being in business with the artist, and you're helping that artist build verticals, whether it's clothing lines, television shows, all of these things or whatever. So now the labels have finally figured out, you know, this income on streaming is going to erode. We got to figure out how to be in business with them holistically. But managers are a lot smarter, and they have a lot of options out there with, you know, a lot of the companies that are going to be on the stage today, where it's like they can find other partners that have experience in helping them build their businesses too.
Let's talk about that, because you have good experience with this. You've managed superstar artists like Eve and Lady Gaga. And we've also seen how the labels as well are starting to think about this. You alluded to it a couple of weeks ago. Universal Music Group had its Capital Markets Day, and as I'm sure you saw, there was that breakdown of streaming 1.0 and streaming 2.0. And their way that they had it was streaming 1.0 was focused on what streaming has largely looked like today. $10.99, all you can eat buffet, all you can consume for your music. Streaming 2.0 is exactly what Troy's talking about. What are those added things? And I think that premium tier that you're hearing people talk about is a lot of that. I think the question for the industry is, what is that offering going to be through that premium tier? And is that going to be something that fans want, that fans are clamoring for? Because sometimes you hear that it's a bit more focused on monetization, which it should be. But if you want people to buy something, it needs to come directly from what fans are actually willing to pay.
Yeah. And the question is, are artists and their teams going to be willing to give up certain things? You know, so if you're doing a premium offering with X streaming services, then that means fans on this streaming services aren't going to get that. And the way real artists think about fans, they want to make sure fans have access, because it's very easy to piss fans off. You know, so you want to make sure, like, because even with concerts, it's like you got certain people that are going to pay $1,500 for a ticket that are going to be front row, but you got fans up in the nosebleeds that might pay $40 or whatever, but they're all getting the same experience essentially. So that's the part they got to be careful of, is like, you got to understand the psyche of the artist, and you also have to understand the psyche of the consumer. We'll see about this. If the bet is on, we're going to make more money just by this new sort of super premium tier, and that's where growth is going to come from, I'm shorting that bet all day long.
Actually, quick show of hands in here from the room. This is probably a bit of a skewed room, but how many of you currently pay for a music streaming service? Okay, most hands. How many of you would pay twice what you pay now if they were to raise the price for that same service? All right, a fair amount of hands, and I think that probably is most of us, but again, we're a fraction.
These the same people who paid $1,000 a ticket too, by the way.
That is true. That is true.
Normal consumers are different. Like, so when you got to choose between gas for your car, Netflix subscription, food, like all of these things that add up, you hit a point where it's like, I might go to another service, I might downgrade. There is going to be price sensitivity at some point with it. And especially, we got to be very, very careful with music, because we got it to a point where we finally got people to pay for it and it's still available for free. So we don't want to push people to that point where they go back to having to find it for free, or they go to, you know, the cheaper ad supported tiers that we're trying to get people out of or whatever. So we still have to figure out what that sensitivity level is before we really push people to the brink.
Because that always felt like that was the rub there. I would always see the reports, and I'm sure many of you have probably seen the reports too. People would compare, look at how much the monthly price of one of the major streaming services has increased compared to the price of Netflix. And there would be some charts saying that Netflix price is as 4X. Well, the difference is that you can't watch the full season of Stranger Things for ad supported on YouTube. That doesn't work in that same way, but that's the case in music. So music has always had that as the BATNA, your best alternative. How do you compete against that? Because that's always going to be a floor that you have to compete with.
You know, we come from a world where I think seeing things through the lens of a manager and a label are two different things. So where the label has always been sort of hyper-focused around the song, essentially, and that's been an important thing, and that's where the incentives lie. And so with a manager, we always had to look at the business holistically. Even now, in the way we work with artists, it's like, okay, how are you looking at every single vertical? We're in an age where there's going to be multiples of billion-dollar artists. You know, what we're seeing now is just a groundwork of what the future is going to look like. You know, Spotify paid out $100 million to Taylor Swift, you know, for just Spotify. When you think about touring, you think about merch, you think about virtual goods, we haven't even scratched the surface on what AI is going to be able to do for artists in terms of revenue yet. So it's going to be all of these sort of revenue sources. So the growth is naturally going to come. You know, the key is having a strategy to sort of maximize the growth, having a team to actually help you capitalize on the growth, and not rely on, you know, because we're in this stage of everybody sort of chased what was hot on TikTok. Like, we sort of gave the keys to TikTok. TikTok sort of juiced everything up. Everybody sort of bet on ephemeral artists for the most part and ephemeral songs on TikTok, and sort of that's starting to crumble now. And so we got to get to a point where it's like, okay, let's bet on the art, let's bet on the artist, let's bet on the development, and really put strategy around it. And the people who can do that are going to be, you know, build billion-dollar brands with artists.
Let's take a break for our chart metric stat of the week. Ever since Kendrick Lamar dropped his surprise album, GNX, the online searches for the 1980s dance pop singer Debbie Deb have been through the roof. In the 3 days before the album came out, her total views on her Wikipedia page were 447. On the day that GNX was released, and the 2 days after that, since the album included a sample of her 1983 song When I Hear Music on the second track of Kendrick's album Squabble Up, her Wikipedia pages have totaled 10,483 visits. That is quite the jump. There's a jump in general across the board if you look at her stats, but the Wikipedia one definitely stood out. Let's get back to the episode. Let's talk about the TikTok piece, because you said that it crumbled, and I do think that there's definitely been some challenges there. I also remember there was an interview you did recently. This was right around the time where TikTok and Universal Music Group had their spat about whether or not royalties should or shouldn't be paid up to a certain level. And I think it's pretty clear that after Taylor Swift made the move that she made, that Universal Music Group didn't necessarily win that dispute. How do you think that will continue to evolve? Because on one hand, you can look and say TikTok won with that. But on the other hand, we saw that it's harder than ever to really have true artist development come from that platform.
When I left Spotify, one of the first calls I got was from Rain Group, who told me that I should meet the people who just bought Musical.ly because they were launching the new platform, TikTok. And me and my co-founder, Susie, flew to China, spent some time with them, and really got to know that original team, like who was bringing TikTok to America. And one, they showed me what they were gonna do on the music side with their music app. And one of the conversations that I had with them was, why don't you guys partner up with the labels? Because the labels don't want to give free ad-supported tiers to anybody anymore. But think about what Hulu was able to do in terms of launching Hulu, because you had Netflix, who was the 800-pound gorilla in the room or whatever. And so to launch a competitive streaming service that had the best interests of content owners, Hulu was like a good example. And so it was, take it to the labels, give everybody some real skin in the game. And it could be very, very competitive, by the way, because everybody's incentivized to put their best content into this thing, really invest in the artist development on this platform or whatever, and couldn't get figured out. So with it not being able to get figured out, you gave the keys away again. TikTok works great in terms of what you needed to do. But when you talk about us as an industry and what's in our best interest in terms of building superstars, developing artists, and also helping to develop entrepreneurs, companies, and through monetization, that's not their goal. And in order for this to work, you need partners in this ecosystem that whose incentives are aligned with our industry. If their incentives aren't aligned with our industry, then that's where it's a problem. So when me going inside of Spotify, Lior going inside of YouTube, Jimmy and Larry going inside of Apple, it was people who were actually internally helping to align interests and being able to explain why this is important. And some great things actually came out of that in terms of building real partnerships or whatever. I think we have to hold all partners who are coming into our industry who we're giving content to accountable for that.
I'm glad you mentioned those transitions. I was going to ask you about that. You being at Spotify, Larry Jackson and Jimmy Iovine going to Apple Music, and then Lior Cohen going to YouTube Music, because it obviously was intentional. And I do think that at least from the outside, it did help with the relations with it. I think you probably seen it pretty dominantly at YouTube, where Lior has seemed to be a cheerleader, be like, yes, we want to be the number one contributor of revenue for the music industry. Since that playbook was so clear that that's how they've done it, why do you think that other companies didn't follow that same playbook?
You mean other technology companies?
Right.
I think some have tried, but me, Lior, and you're talking about strong personalities who built a lot of trust as well with the music community and with the technology community as well.
Yeah.
And so when you bring in people, and this was one of the big things with Spotify and why that relationship worked, was because coming in, I had to tell them I cannot jeopardize my trust with my people. So, me being able to get people to trust Spotify was people trusting me that I wasn't going to let Spotify do anything that, like, you can't screw these people over. So if I'm going in this room and I'm talking to these managers, these artists, these publishers, these songwriters, these labels, I got to give it to them straight or whatever. So I got to have like Spotify's best interest in that room, and I got to have the music community's best interest in these rooms. And that's what Jimmy and Lior have been able to do. And you also have a level of influence where you can get people to do what you need them to do because they trust you. And I think certain instances, some of the technology companies, they've tried to do their versions of that, but I don't think you necessarily had the people who could move the needle.
The other thing that's tough from what I've seen from those companies is they've had people, like I've known people that came from music that worked in TikTok, and their role was to help with the relations and all of that, but then TikTok lays those people off. And I'm not trying to call out any company specifically, but there's that type of trend that we've seen, and we get it. There's been market shifts and things like that, but yeah, it feels like
this is how you do it. This is a relationship business. We all know this is a very small industry. A lot of people know each other. And how do we just get more of that? Because it's funny, we're talking in the back room earlier. We're talking a bit about Netflix and about Ted Sarandos and how you have a creative leading that business. And I think sometimes in this industry, when people see creatives leading businesses, there could be a bit of apprehension additionally, because there's some of that tension that's always been there between creative and business. But then you compound that now with creative business and tech. And it's like, how can we harmonize all of this and help the industry forward?
One of the first questions that went into Spotify, I had a conversation with Ted Sarandos, who's CEO of Netflix now. And I was asking Ted how they managed to have like a technology company that works in a creative community, and you know how it worked. And his answer was about them building two distinct healthy cultures, because technology culture works a certain way and creative culture works a certain way. And being able to build the best technology, because you know we take video streaming for granted now, but you know when you think about it, Netflix did something very revolutionary in terms of building like out video streaming at the scale that they were able to do it. And at the same time, to be able to know what shows to license, what producers to bring on for original content, how to scale that globally. You got to have very talented creative people in there. So what they did was built a culture of healthy respect on both sides. But technology reported into Reed and creative reported into Ted. And I don't know if you could build that same type of company if you had somebody from technology running that company, or even somebody from creative running that company to build, you know, something like that. So there's a very unique structure that they did, and it really worked. So it's something that people should really look at and think about replicating as you're trying to do that.
Right, because in general, co-CEO leadership has always been a bit controversial. Some people love it, some people do not love it. It's probably less common than it is common.
It's usually when people can't make a decision or scared to make a decision, right, is when they say we're going to do co.
Right, or like no one wants to like anger the other person, yeah, right? But eventually they made the shift where I feel like even a few years on, it was like clear, okay, Ted is probably going to lead this company and Reed is probably going to pull back into more of a chairman role. And it would be interesting to see how the music business would go from that perspective, because of course there's the majors. We all know the people leading those companies, and we've definitely seen some shifts there with certain majors. But you do start to see a bit more of a mix on the independent side, whether that is with the non-major labels, which have considerable growing share, or with the music distribution and services company like Venice Music and the one you lead as well. So we do see a bit of that mix.
You know, you can't build a modern music company without technology. Like, so every company is going to be a technology company. No matter what business you're in, you're going to be a technology company. It's not a lot of music people who understand technology, which is scary. And so knowing what's coming down the pipeline and how the entire world's going to change and how content's going to look different, if you don't really have a core understanding of technology and what the future really looks like and actually know how it's going to work, you're in trouble. So it's like when I look at even now, you know, the most recent Hollywood negotiations, you know, with the unions and everything else or whatever, I was talking to one film director and we were debating about AI. And, you know, she was like really out in front with the union with negotiations. And I'm like, okay, the union sort of said, okay, we're not going to let AI take jobs and it only can do this with writers and all of that. But the next big movie studios aren't going to be what we see today. And you guys don't have contracts with them. So there's going to be new companies that are going to be the new Pixars, the new Paramount, all of these companies within the next 10 years, by the way. We're going to see multi-billion dollar companies in this space. Same exact thing with music. So when you can find the right people that know how to make records with and people with taste, and you can marry them with people who know how to build technology and scale companies, they're going to run circles around what we see right now. And because everybody's just sort of rooted in the past and have this sort of, we're going to litigate our way to growth, or we're going to litigate our way to the future, but we're not going to build that internal. They're going to give it away again.
So do you feel like it's inevitable 10 years from now, we look at the largest companies in the space based on market cap? You think it'll look very different?
Hell yeah. I remember when we were talking about Spotify hitting 1 million subs and what the valuation was back then, right? A smaller example is DistroKid. Phil made a lot of money. He's done incredibly well. Somebody mentioned earlier about, they said, Troy, did you see like the music exec salary thing that came out or whatever? I was like, yeah. But Phil probably has more money than all of them.
Yeah.
So the winners, people don't know who these winners are going to be. And I would be willing to bet anything that in 10 years, who we see that owns market share right now is going to look totally different at 100%. We knew 5-6 years ago, a company around independent music, if I didn't know what independent market share was going to look like. It's like, it's a reason why independent market share is growing the way it's growing right now, whatever. So I think it's going to look totally different.
So you're telling me the richest people in this industry aren't the people that are 1 through 10 on the power players list? That's what you're telling me? Before we wrap things up, I wanted to talk about a book that you had referenced in an interview. I think you did an interview recently with Mauricio Ruiz, Jesse Reyes's manager, and you were talking about the Morgan Housel book, The Psychology of Money. Mm-hmm. Has anyone here read that book? And then he also had another book, The Same as Ever, A Guide to What Hasn't Changed. Anyone read that one? Okay, I see a few hands too. But one of the things that I think was really important in that book was he talks about not just how people invest their money, but what trends that they bet on are things that, regardless of how technology evolves, regardless of how trends go, what are the things that will be the same? What are the things that will remain the same? And I think that's a helpful way to think about music as we're thinking about where to build, where to invest, where to put these dollars. Are there certain things you think about from reading that book or others that make you think, okay, these are the things to always bet on. These are the things to always invest in that won't change about this industry.
Taste. When everybody has the same exact tools, right? You know, we're entering this age right now where it doesn't matter if you went to Stanford, Yale, the best schools in the world. It doesn't matter if you work for Pixar. None of this stuff is going to matter because of the tools that are available now to give you all of the information. You could sing like Adele now if you want. You could do all of these things. But the taste layer on top of it is going to be incredibly important. So whether we're investing in entrepreneurs or we're investing in artists, it's like, do they have that feel? And that feel is going to be incredibly hard to replicate right now. Like, technology is going to get incredibly close to it. But I feel like for the near future, human taste is going to matter on top of this.
That makes sense. Well, I'd love to go deeper with that, but before we wrap things up, let's do a quick lightning round question. So, of course, the topic of this session is what's next, the road ahead. And streaming has been the dominant form for this industry for a while. That's where a majority of the revenue comes from. But as you and I both know, no medium stays on top forever, right? And they rarely have a 20-year run, and we're already getting close to that with streaming. So for your 30-second prediction, what format do you think will be the one that will be most likely to dominate revenue in music moving forward?
I think this sort of combination of synthetic artists with sort of the, I don't want to cheapen the technology, but what Industrial Light and Magic were able to do for ABBA, you know, in terms of the live experience, I think there's a combination of artificial intelligence and this sort of holographic, like high-end holographic imaging that seems actually real. Because what it's going to do is the audience won't be able to tell the difference. They will not be able to tell the difference. So when you go to whatever streaming service that will be, you won't know whether that is human artists or a synthetic artist. And when you go see them live, you will not know whether that's a human artist or a synthetic artist. and the audience won't care. The audience won't care. And that really, really scales huge. Because at that point, you could do it in every language. You could do it in all parts of the world. And then when you're, and then there's ways for real artists to be able to use that technology to be able to scale their businesses as well. And it takes away from the purity that our industry sort of thrives on and it's married to, but the genie's out of the bottle and the audience doesn't care and they're going to really gravitate towards it and is going to be hugely competitive what the legacy music industry is today.
We'll definitely have to follow up on that one. Well, Troy, thank you for coming on. Ladies and gentlemen, Troy Carter.
Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. Send it to one or two people you think would really get value out of listening to this episode. And while you're at it, if you could rate and review the show, that would be great. Rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts, rate the podcast on Spotify, rate the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps make sure that the word gets out about Trapital and what we're building here. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you next time.